The only Democrat so far to file for Montana's U.S. House seat in 2014 is officially kicking off his campaign. Candidate John Lewis worked for Senator Max Baucus for the last 12 years, serving as his state director for the last 3 years. He left that job earlier this year to begin working on his campaign. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce spoke with Lewis for a few minutes during today's kickoff event.
I'm here today to officially announce I'm running for the U.S. House of Representatives.
A small crowd of local Democratic operatives and well-wishers welcomes John Lewis to a stage in a Helena Union Hall. He's a fourth-generation Montanan, raised in both Billings and Missoula. He says he's running as a concerned father of two young kids and as a dedicated public servant, not as a politician.
Living within our means, but also making responsible decisions, and what's not responsible is what's going on back there right now, especially with the shutdown.
But your professional life has been political. It's been involved in politics and working for a partisan figure, Senator Max Baucus. Mm-hmm. So what do you mean by saying that you are entering not as a politician?
Mm-hmm. Well, look, my service is what it is. I mean, I'm proud of that service, when I look at my service in terms of working for Senator Baucus, it was, helping people. And both, in the legislative side of things when I worked in D.C. and here in Montana, and there's nothing partisan about that. When I traveled to all these communities, I did not hear a lot of partisan politics. I heard about people upset about, that Congress is not doing the things that help working families in Montana. We're talking about a farm bill. And talking about highway bill, we're talking about regular spending bills that help, deliver clean drinking water and wastewater systems in Montana. There's nothing partisan about those issues. And we're not seeing enough of that in D.C.
You also mentioned traveling as Senator Baucus' state director to Montana's 56 counties, striving to meet with leaders in the 129 incorporated cities and towns. That trip, how did that inform your politics? How did that mold your vision for what you'd like to see as your candidacy?
Mm-hmm. The thing I heard over and over again was, not enough, action on the part of Congress to help working families. And it's things that regular working families expect the federal government to do, like a farm bill. I was over in eastern Montana, in the Bakken region, and, I saw the challenges that they're facing, in terms of housing and law enforcement. And, it was very apparent to me that people are sick and tired of Congress not getting the job done.
Some voters will see you as a political insider, not necessarily new blood. Mm-hmm. What practical steps and what specific steps can you take to help put an end to the current constant cycle of stalemate and gridlock in Congress?
Mm-hmm. Well, look, I have no illusions that one person can suddenly change the way Congress operates easily. But it's got to start somewhere, I've seen up close, what is not working in the legislative process, I've also seen what does work. And so I'm somebody that could hit the ground running, but, it's not going to be easy. And we're not to a point even where, Congress is even discussing solutions to many of these issues. The government's shut down, and later this week, we could potentially default on the debt limit. That's irresponsible. We can do better. There's no question we can do better.
So when you Google John Lewis, the first sponsored site that comes up is a site from the Republican National Campaign Committee, I believe, and it's attacking you and your record and your affiliation with Senator Baucus, a lead crafter of the Affordable Care Act, which is a very unpopular law in the state of Montana. Mm-hmm. Is your association with Senator Baucus, and therefore an association with the Affordable Care Act, will that hinder your campaign?
Mm-hmm. Well, number one, the fact that, I'm already under attack and, I haven't even announced yet, shows the challenges I'll face, as a candidate. In terms of, the Affordable Care Act and all that, look, we need to insure more Americans in, cost of insurance, is going through the roof for individuals, for businesses, and part of the problem is insuring more Americans, Is the Affordable Care Act perfect? No. Does it need improvements? Absolutely. One thing I learned working in the legislative process, you know, is that no legislation that's passed is perfect. You need to make improvements on things.
I look forward to seeing you all again on the campaign trail very soon. And let's get to work.
On the Republican side of the House race, many expect current Republican Congressman Steve Daines to run for the U.S. Senate seat being vacated by Max Baucus in 2014. Several other Republican candidates are already running for the House seat or say they will if Daines switches races. Those Republicans include former State Senator Corey Stapleton and current State Representative Champ Edmonds. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
You can hear more of Dan's interview with Democratic U.S. House candidate John Lewis on our website. That's mtpr.org.
And in other news from around the state, the chairman of the Blackfeet Indian Tribe has asked a tribal council member and state senator to remove himself from his duties until his legal troubles are behind him. Senator Shannon Ogier rejected the request, saying Chairman Willie Sharp Jr. made it after Ogier questioned some of the chairman's actions. Sharp wrote Ogier a letter on Friday requesting he, quote, respectfully step away, end quote, from tribal business and, quote, determine what avenue is to be taken, end quote, when Ogier's charges are resolved. Ogier is charged with misdemeanor counts of drunken driving, reckless driving, and obstruction of a peace officer. He's accused of fleeing a sheriff's deputy during a traffic stop earlier this year. Ogier says he will continue doing his job unless a majority of the tribal council asks him to step down.
Missoula City Council members met with the Salish Pend'ere Culture Committee in St. Ignatius today to discuss the possibility of incorporating Native language into Missoula signs. City Councilman Dave Strohmeyer says council members are looking for more ways to recognize Missoula's significance to the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes.
Really gain information in terms of what are those areas of cultural significance in Missoula that deserve and ought to have additional recognition through translation into Native language, and also looking forward to creating educational features in our community like interpretive panels maybe along our trail system that really go into detail about the history of Salish occupation of this place that we call Missoula.
Strohmeyer says the council wanted to meet on Columbus Day to recognize Missoula Valley's deep-rooted heritage.
Being Columbus Day, I think from a symbolic standpoint, it's critical that we recognize that the history of North America and here in Western Montana did not begin with the first railroad that transversed or crossed the continent. It's a culture that goes long and deep in this place, and we need to recognize it. It's part of social justice.
Late last year, the Missoula City Council formally recognized government-to-government relations between the CSKT Tribal Council and the city. Earlier this year, the City Council and the Tribal Council met in what is thought to be the first joint meeting of its kind.
A legal clash over water rights on an arid northern plains goes to trial this week as attorneys for Montana press their case that Wyoming farmers and oil and gas companies are sucking too much water from tributaries of the Yellowstone River. Montana sued its southern neighbor in 2007. It claims Wyoming is violating a 1950 agreement by depleting the Tongue and Powder Rivers before they flow north into Montana. Among the contested issues is whether natural gas drilling in Wyoming is draining underground aquifers that feed the two rivers. A weeks-long trial to determine if Wyoming should be held liable begins Wednesday in a federal courtroom in Billings. The U.S. Supreme Court has appointed Stanford Law School professor Barton Thompson Jr. to oversee the case.
Two 90-year-old World War II veterans from Montana defied a barrier that closed the Lincoln Memorial and climbed the stairs to see the marble statue. A.L. Frederick of Billings, who was named after the 16th president, told the Billings Gazette yesterday he was honored to walk up to the memorial. Frederick and William Cernulevic were assisted up the stairs by veterans of the Vietnam War and the Korean War as onlookers cheered. The two men are among 83 veterans who traveled to Washington, D.C. this weekend as part of the 7th Big Sky Honor Flight. The veterans were able to tour the Korean War Memorial and the Vietnam Veterans Memorial yesterday. They started their tour Monday at the World War II Memorial, then stopped at Arlington National Cemetery.
Anaconda Deer Lodge County prosecutors do not intend to seek the death penalty against a 38-year-old Washington State man charged with killing his 3-year-old son near Anaconda in July. The Montana Standard reports the trial for Jeremy Brent Kramer of Lacey, Washington, has been set to start on April 7, 2014. He would face up to life in prison if convicted of mitigated deliberate homicide in the death of his son, Broderick. Kramer pleaded not guilty in August to beating and stabbing his son, possibly while under the influence of prescription stimulants. He remained jailed on $250,000 bond. Employees at the Anaconda convenience store called police after seeing Kramer trying to wash blood from his clothing in the restroom. The boy's body was found near Kramer's abandoned truck.
A 46-year-old Libby woman was killed and her passenger was injured in a weekend all-terrain vehicle crash near Libby. The Montana Highway Patrol reports the crash happened yesterday at about noon on Parmenter Creek Road southwest of Libby. The patrol says the woman lost control while making a sharp turn onto a trail and the ATV tipped. She died at the scene. Her name hasn't been released. KCI-TV reports the passenger, a 53-year-old woman from Washington State, was taken to the Kalispell Hospital with unknown injuries. The patrol says neither woman was wearing a helmet.
An eastbound freight train collided with a truck carrying a load of sugar beets in Hysham, injuring the driver. Dennis Cobb, owner of Cobb Brothers Farms, tells the Billings Gazette his driver suffered several cracked vertebrae in the collision yesterday morning. He was taken to the hospital in Billings. BNSF Railway spokesman Matt Jones says no BNSF employees were injured in the collision. Jones says the railroad and local law enforcement are investigating.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Tamara Jones knows more than most about the aftermath of tragedy. Jones, the University of Montana 2013 Polner Distinguished Professor, worked as a feature writer for the Associated Press, the Los Angeles Times, and the Washington Post. She shares the Pulitzer for breaking news for the Washington Post's coverage of the 2007 massacre at Virginia Tech. She was dispatched to put a human face on tragedy. Over the course of her career, she covered the very first postal shooting in Oklahoma back in 1986, the Oklahoma City bombing, the D.C. snipers, the O.J. Simpson trial, Ted Bundy, the Green River Killer, terrorist bombings in London, and, of course, the September 11th attacks. Violence and human suffering has been the dominant theme of her 30-year career. In this evening's feature interview, Jones tells Edward O'Brien that for a very long time, she didn't think those stories affected her personal life very much.
As journalists, we were always taught to keep your subjects at arm's distance. And you came to think of the notebook almost as a shield. I remember, for me, the real turning point was Oklahoma City. And that was true if you talked to journalists who covered that. For a year or more afterwards, when we would see each other at different news events, the subject would come up and people would say, did you feel really depressed after Oklahoma City? Did Oklahoma City change you? So I know from my colleagues that it affected many of us. I think part of it was just the shock of the magnitude of it. And also that we all felt so vulnerable then. It wasn't something that you could hold at arm's distance any longer. It hadn't happened to them anymore, whoever they were, you know, these tragic victims that we always wrote about. Oklahoma City, in a way, happened to all of us. The first place I felt it was outside a church that was the clearinghouse for information for the families who were looking for missing loved ones. And my assignment in Oklahoma City was to reconstruct what had happened that morning in the daycare center that was in the federal building. 15 children from that daycare center would end up among the 680 dead from Oklahoma City. And usually when you go as a member of the press, or my experience had been, to the scene of a disaster or tragedy, what I came to call the people would be there. People who had been drawn to the scene to watch the rescue operations or keep vigil. They were the ones who would hold candles and leave teddy bears. And whenever we were there, there was this kind of unspoken resentment between the media and these people. Sometimes they would curse us and call us media vultures. And we would, at least I know I would privately sometimes think that they were attention seekers, or worse, just idle spectators. I think we quietly challenged each other's right to be there. And Oklahoma City was different. That didn't happen. When I was waiting outside the church for people to come out, because the families would come out to talk to the press to see if we had heard anything and to share their stories. And while I was waiting, it started to rain. And as Salvation Army volunteers came out from the church with umbrellas for us and sandwiches. I didn't want to take the food because it felt like I was accepting some gift that had been intended for the families inside. And I remember the Salvation Army lady just said, "Take it. There's plenty in there. You must be hungry." So I took the sandwich and she walked away and I just started to cry. Oklahoma City turned out to be the place where, at the age of, I was in my 30s, it was the first funeral I had ever been to. As a child, when my grandparents had died and my mom came back to Missoula, she had left the kids behind in California because she said a funeral was no place for children. In Oklahoma City, I went to the funeral of Chase and Colton Smith, and they were brothers who were 2 and 3 years old. They shared the same very tiny white casket. I remember the soloist sang the Barney song as the coffin was carried to the hearse. So, you know, obviously, Oklahoma City was a turning point. I did begin feeling the stories more after that. And I also began re-examining who, what I called the people, were at these sites and what motivated them. I know that you could call a pop psychologist who would tell you that they're drawn there maybe by a form of survivor's guilt or wanting to identify with the victims, so that could have been me. But I came to think it was something a little more complicated than that, and that our motivations, really, as journalists and as survivors, onlookers, bystanders on these outskirts of grief, weren't so different. I think that we all go through life thinking that we are living these individual stories, and we each have our own narrative. But when the unspeakable happens, when these acts of violence, these shootings and bombings and terrorism occur, it shocks us out of that sort of singular story. And I think we come looking for our place in the greater narrative. We're trying to find our thread and where we belong in that story. And compassion is the most human of emotions. And compassion connects us. And violence is the most horrifying of our experiences, our cruelty to one another. And that connects us too. So I think what brings us all to these scenes, whether we're physically there or glued to a television set, watching hours and hours of coverage from one of these sites, is almost a collective loneliness in a way.
Is this the intimacy of violence that you write of?
That's what I'm calling the intimacy of violence.
Do you have any insight from your perspective and the work you have done on what is leading to this? One event is more shocking, more horrifying than the next. What's going on?
I don't know. Who does know? I think the slaying of 5 school children in an Amish schoolhouse was as shocking as the mass shootings at Virginia Tech So it doesn't have to do, I think, with the number of people killed. Look at other things that are going on in our society. I read recently that something like 1 out of every 5 girls and 1 out of every 7 boys engage in self-harm, mostly cutting themselves. I know that didn't exist when I was in high school. When you look into it, this is millions of kids. I think they said something like 2 million every year diagnosed with it. And it's not considered a suicide attempt. They say that they do it for the most part because they feel numb. They don't feel anything. They want to feel something. Cutting themselves and seeing their own blood, it provides a sense of relief to them because it's proof that they can feel something again. And you may think, well, what's that got to do with shootings or anything? I don't know that it does. I'm just saying that if you look at the whole emotional picture of mainly young people today, it's a vastly more complicated and more frightening picture than there had been when I was a kid. That we see more sociopathic behavior, and everybody talks about how blank the killers always were. You know, they almost never say anything to their victims.
How do you care for yourself after a career of this sort of thing, may I ask?
After Oklahoma City, I lost faith in the world. And I talked to friends. But I remember when I came back, I also became suddenly absolutely obsessed with getting kittens. I'm single. I travel a lot. I don't have children. But my kitten clock went off big time. And it wasn't just, I think I'll go to the shelter. I was determined, and I did eventually get to, I needed something life-affirming and innocent, unconditional in my life, and also easy to care for. Sometimes it comes up in stupid, superficial ways like that, of taking care of yourself. And telling the stories is therapeutic in a way, too.
I remember September 11th, not to drag myself into this, worked here, you know, a long ways away, but still it was a very intense day. And I went home, and my dog and a neighbor dog were just wrestling and irritating each other, and I started crying, watching them do their thing. You know, I think you put it very well, the innocence of it all, conflicted with the horror that was happening.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, too, because a lot of times, I think when people and pundits or whatever talk about us becoming numb to the violence, and it's like they expect some kind of mass synchronized reaction to it beyond the donations, the marches, things like that. And in my experience in that, what I've seen for a lot of people in a lot of situations is that stress and grief are often a delayed reaction. And so you may think, oh, these people are just kind of blithely sitting there in their living rooms watching coverage of Newtown and maybe talking about it at the water cooler. But then what you're not seeing are a week later or a month later, the person who suddenly doesn't know why they're crying when Hey Jude comes on the car radio. Or, like you said, when a puppy starts playing it with its litter mates or something completely unrelated. You know, it's like the tender trigger in us. So just because you don't see the reaction that you think we're quote-unquote supposed to have at the moment doesn't mean that a million reactions aren't happening that you don't see much later.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Tamara Jones will deliver the University of Montana School of Journalism's T. Anthony Polder Lecture tonight, 7 o'clock, at the University Center Theater on the University of Montana campus. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Continental Divide tonight, expect mostly clear skies and lows in the 20s. Tomorrow should be mostly clear with highs in the upper 40s to mid 50s. For central Montana tonight, you should see mostly clear skies and lows 25 to 30 degrees, while tomorrow expect mostly clear skies and highs 50 to 60 degrees. And in southwest Montana tonight, you should see mostly clear skies, lows 25 to 30 degrees, and tomorrow, again, mostly clear skies, highs 40 to 50 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Julia Altimus.
This week marks the third annual Montana Forest Products Week. In 2011, the state legislature set aside a week every October in order to recognize the value of Montana's forest products industry, their contribution to the management of our forest lands, and to the stability of Montana's economy. The week, commencing October 18th and running through October 24th, is a wonderful opportunity for the public and Montana's elected officials to learn more about an industry that has been instrumental in the growth of Montana's economy since the F.H. Stoltz Land and Lumber Company established at its current Half Moon site just northwest of Columbia Falls in 1912. Montana's Appreciation Week coincides with the National Forest Products Week, established by a joint resolution of Congress in 1960. The joint resolution proclaimed that our country and its people have always found constant strength, individual peace, and personal pride in the bounty of forest and timberland. And from the beginning of our nation's founding, the forest and its products provided a core of living and freedom, touching and inspiring each citizen with majestic beauty and practical use. As our only renewable resource, wood offers the availability and abundance to satisfy the nation's ever-growing demand. And through modern forestry, we can be assured of a continuous supply of timber for the future. U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack states, "Wood should be a major component of American building and energy design. The use of wood provides substantial environmental benefits, provides incentives for private landowners to maintain forest land, and provides a critical source of jobs in rural America. Utilizing wood harvested through sustainable forestry practices in green building applications promotes a healthy environment and a strong economy." Wood as a green product has long been recognized by the wood products industry nationwide through a life cycle analysis, which is a well-established set of methods for measuring the environmental impacts of a product or service across its entire life cycle, identifying the flow of materials and energy through the various stages, from the point of harvesting raw material through manufacturing, construction, use, and finally disposal. This cradle-to-grave assessment demonstrates using lumber or wood products in residential and non-residential construction leaves one of the smallest carbon footprints. In addition, when the entire life cycle of lumber is accounted for, each ton of wood carbon replaces up to 2.1 tons of atmospheric carbon. Sustainable forest management produces healthier forests that serve as a carbon sink, absorbing greenhouse gases and purifying drinking water for wildlife in municipal water systems. This year alone, forests sequestered 14% of all atmospheric carbon. Timber is among Montana's most highly valued resources. For over a century, this plentiful, renewable, and natural resource has sustained jobs and communities. In fact, today, over 160 wood manufacturing businesses in Montana employ roughly 6,700 people, provide labor income of $295 million, and product sales of roughly $900 million every year in the primary and secondary wood products manufacturing sectors. Traditionally, Montana's wood products focused on producing dimensional lumber for building and wood fiber for the pulp and paper industry. Today, Montana's manufacturing consists of sawmills, plywood, fiberboard, and particle board plants, pellet mills, biomaterial and sustainable building material companies, log and furniture manufacturers, planers, and woodworks. In addition to producing a wide variety of sustainably harvested wood products, Montana's forest products industry provides a workforce for trail restoration, wildlife habitat enhancement, forest and riparian restoration, hazardous fuel reduction, fire suppression, and many other activities. Montana's forest products industry is proud to promote healthy forests and healthy communities through the wise management of our forest lands. Forest Products Week is a great time to celebrate all the things we use and enjoy that come from trees. On behalf of the Montana Wood Products Association, I am Julia Altimus. Thanks for listening.
Julia Altimus is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.